Although the following conversation is sponsored by John Hancock, the opinions and legal views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily reflect John Hancock's views on any of the issues discussed. Please listen to the important disclosures at the end of this broadcast.
On this edition of John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio, we will discuss common estate planning mistakes and how to avoid them. With Carly Brooks, Associate Counsel at John Hancock's Advanced Markets, and with Emil Weinstock, of counsel with Morgan, Lewis & Bockius. I'm Tanya Ittings, and you're listening to John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carly Brooks. Welcome to today's edition of John Hancock Advanced Markets Radio. In a perfect world, we as advisors would love for our clients to come to us before they engage in planning. But what oftentimes happens is we are brought in to assist on planning issues that arise after the fact. So after trusts have been executed, insurance policies have been issued, or individuals have died. Today, we're here to talk about some of the common estate planning mistakes that we see in the life insurance space, how they can be avoided, and how advisors can help their clients to be proactive and consistent in planning. Here to enlighten us and educate us today on some of the common mistakes that arise and how we can try to avoid these issues, I am so pleased to welcome Emil Weinstock to our show.
My pleasure.
Emil is of counsel with the law firm of Morgan, Lewis & Bockius. Morgan, Lewis is a full-service international law firm with almost 2,000 lawyers in 30 offices across the globe. Emil's practice includes working with clients and their advisors to develop and prepare sophisticated and appropriate estate plans for high-net-worth families. Emil is frequently asked to serve as trustee for his clients, and he brings experience in advising individual and corporate fiduciaries regarding ongoing obligations and responsibilities to trust beneficiaries. Emil also provides guidance to clients and their trustees concerning the fiduciary responsibilities associated with holding life insurance policies inside trusts. He collaborates with insurance teams in preparing comprehensive policy reviews, including detailed analysis of existing life insurance, ownership structure, and any other options available to improve the overall situation for a client. Emil is an ACTEC Fellow and has spoken on numerous occasions at the Boston Bar Association, MCLE, TEC, and the Massachusetts Bar Association on various estate planning topics. He's currently chairing a program he developed for the Trust and Estates section of the Boston Bar Association that works for mid-level law firm associates to help them become better public speakers. So as you can see, Emil has a very impressive background, and we are so excited to have you on our program today.
Thank you, Carly. You left out my best attribute, which is I have a great face for radio.
Well, welcome. To kick off today's show, Emil, something we unfortunately see time and time again are life insurance policies being purchased and then largely forgotten about, especially when they are held in life insurance trusts. So what are some of the most common issues that you see with this, and how can advisors help their clients, or in the case of trust-owned policies, trustees, correct these problems before it's too late?
Well, Carly, this is quite a loaded question. There are so many things that people ignore when it comes to life insurance trusts. I'll get to the most critical issue, which is the policy itself, in a few minutes. But before I do that, I think it's worth pointing out a few basic administrative things that are often overlooked. The bottom line is that every trustee has to respect the formalities of the trust itself. That also goes for the grantor of the trust and typically the beneficiaries as well. It may sound surprising, but the first thing I always ask is, have you read the trust? This is such a rudimentary task, but a trust can be daunting when you look at it at first, right? Lots of pages, lots of legalese, long run-on sentences, antiquated vocabulary like per stirpes and interorum, and a myriad of tax clauses. But, you know, despite all of that, it's really upon the client, it's upon the advisors, upon the trustees to actually read the trust carefully and try to understand its terms. And if you don't understand it at first read, call somebody and ask them for help. I find that when I'm working in a partnership scenario with other advisors, if I'm the expert on trusts, I want the other advisors to say, look, I read through the trust. I didn't understand this clause. Can you explain it to me? We do the same thing for our clients, right? We don't expect our clients to understand every clause in the trust when they read it the first time. And we give them the opportunity to call us or email us with questions about that. You know, we're the ones that have been trained on that. The same way that lawyers can't be expected to read in-force illustrations in the same way that life insurance professionals can. We don't expect life insurance professionals or clients to understand trust the way that we do. But the trust needs to be read anyways and understood, because there are some provisions in there that advisors will become more familiar with and will understand how they apply, especially in the context of life insurance, and what they need to do to follow through with that. Among those issues where there's a lot of flexibility and on the administrative side, where people need to pay close attention, are the crummy withdrawal provisions, right? The crummy withdrawal provisions. I mean, that's something you hear that phrase dropped a lot, and I don't know if everybody understands exactly what that means, so maybe it's worth it to go through a little bit of a review of what crummy withdrawal rights are. And the reason I'm doing this is because crummy withdrawal rights, this is the fundamental component of life insurance trust. It's part of how you fund these trusts to cover the premium payments. And the idea is to create a present interest for the gift tax rules so that the donor can use his or her annual exclusion when making gifts to the trust. So that's the basic purpose for what they are. But what people don't realize is that there are different ways to skin that cat, and there are provisions that read differently, and it's important that the trustees certainly understand that, but I think also for life insurance agents to understand that. And I think when you're doing planning, the advisor together with the lawyer who's drafting the trust to be conscientious of what you're trying to achieve from a tax perspective, make sure the trust is drafted appropriately, and make sure the premiums fit nicely within that goal. Again, a little bit of background on crummy. Crummy is actually the name of a case from 1968, and it lucked out in having a great, memorable name that everybody can hang their hat on, which is kind of nice. As I said earlier, the idea behind this was to create a present interest to qualify the contributions to the trust for annual exclusion treatment. You know, after crummy in 1968, there were a number of cases that came afterwards, some revenue rulings from the IRS. And without getting into extraordinary detail on all those cases, I want to make sure that you hear the two main takeaways from the case law on this that really sort of encapsulate what this withdrawal right is all about. There are two factors, right? The first is that in order for this withdrawal right to qualify, the beneficiary, which is the person who has the right to exercise the withdrawal right, must have knowledge of their right to withdraw. Right? That's why we talk about crummy notices, right? A crummy notice is the notice to the beneficiary that gives them the knowledge of their right to make the withdrawal. And number two is the beneficiary has to have the opportunity to actually exercise the right. That, again, comes with the notice, right? If a beneficiary doesn't know and doesn't have the opportunity to actually exercise this withdrawal right, they need to be able to say to the trustee, yes, you know what, in fact, I would like to withdraw my $14,000 this year. Thank you very much. Please issue me a check. If they don't have an opportunity to do that, the IRS will tell the grantor when they audit that, sorry, this did not qualify for annual exclusion treatment. You made a taxable gift, which means that you used up some of your lifetime exemption. So again, it's the idea of giving the beneficiary knowledge and opportunity. So those are the key factors, the most important things. So when we talk about what that means in terms of a crummy notice, right, from a practical perspective, again, read your trust, because the trust then provide different things. Some trusts say, well, you've got to send a notice to each beneficiary, and you've got to give them 30 days to exercise their right to withdraw. Some trusts say 45 days. Some say 60 days. Others say they have the entire calendar year to exercise their withdrawal rights. So you've got to read your trust and understand what your trust says. Hopefully, if you are the drafting attorney, you know what your trust says. But oftentimes, people step into the shoes of a prior attorney, or they take over as trustee, or they're being asked to serve as a trustee of a trust that they did not draft, or you're a life insurance agent and you're working with a client who has a life insurance trust and they're not super familiar, and you say, well, let's see what the trust says. This should be pretty straightforward English to be able to figure out what the withdrawal rights are. But you got to see what they say. You know, there are interesting things. When I first started practice, the law firm that I was in had a program where they would send out a singular notice. This was, let's assume that you funded a trust where the trust was purchasing a level premium policy. And the expectation was that annual premiums were going to be paid on or about, you know, second week of January every single year in the same amount. Well, that firm said, why do we need to give a notice every single year? Why don't we just send a singular notice when the policy is first taken out? You send the beneficiaries a notice that says, hey, on this date, every single year, a contribution is going to be made to the trust in the following amount. You, beneficiary, are going to have the right to withdraw X dollars, and depending on how many beneficiaries there are and how much the contribution was, you can figure out the math, but it'll be the same, assuming those factors stay the same. So you're going to have a right to withdraw X dollars on this date every single year. I'm letting you know that. I'm not going to give you any further notice of this unless something changes, right? Premium goes up, I'll send you a new notice. Additional beneficiary comes in and your rights get fractionalized, I'll give you another notice. But for all intents and purposes, this is your one notice. You now have knowledge. You have the opportunity to exercise this every year. You'll have 30 days to do it, you know, from the first week of January to the first week of February. So be it. I haven't seen other firms doing that, but I don't see that as being a problem within the law. I think it's a fine way to do it. It certainly cuts down on the administrative burden. It certainly eliminates the risk of, gosh, what happens if I forget to send a crummy letter one year? But, you know, one way or the other, you want to find a consistent pattern of how to do these crummy notices. And again, some trust might say, this is all you have to do. As long as the lawyer that's involved is comfortable with that it is in satisfaction of the law, then go right ahead with it. I think it will work. The other thing that comes up in this area, in terms of, you know, when we speak about errors or mistakes or different ways of doing things sometimes, is that many people send crummy notices out to beneficiaries, and on the bottom of their letter, it says, you know, sign here. It's looking for an acknowledgement by the beneficiary that they've received it, and they're asking the beneficiary to sign it and then return it back to the trustee saying, thank you, I now have, you know, it's acknowledging that I have knowledge and opportunity to exercise my right. But what's the problem with that, right? That's my rhetorical question for the morning. The problem is that most of the time, or at least 50% of the time, and I'm throwing out some numbers, I don't know the actual math on that, but a lot of the time, let's say, beneficiaries don't return the letter, so they don't actually acknowledge receipt. Now, from a legal perspective, that's not a problem because, in theory, you've given them the notice that they're requiring. The problem is that you're sort of opening yourself up for questions. If it does ever get audited, the agent says, well, I see that you asked for, you know, signatures here. You didn't get them. What's your proof that you sent it? Because in theory, that's what you're doing. You're relying on that signature to prove that you actually sent the crummy notices. Now, I think that's above and beyond, right? There's no obligation to get back an acknowledgement from the beneficiary that says, I received it, right? What we have to do is prove that we sent it to them and that we told them. And I think from an administrative perspective, if you are sending this notice and you keep a file that says, hey, I mailed this notice on this date, here it is in my file, that's going to be proof enough. I don't think it makes sense to add a line on the bottom asking for this signature back, because I think you just open yourself up to questions and you won't have really a good answer for if you do. The last, call it error or common mistake, if you will, that you see happen in these types of situations is the indirect gift, right? An indirect gift is when, again, you have a life insurance trust. It has a policy inside. It's owned by the trust. And, you know, the best practice, right, is that the grantor makes a gift to the trust. The trust holds on to the cash in the trust for however many number of days it should hold on to for the notice period. And then it pays the premium directly from the trust. That's sort of the best practice. But sometimes clients, I don't know, they fall asleep at the switch and they forget to make the gift despite repeated requests. And you don't want the policy to lapse. And the worst thing, as I don't have to tell the people on this podcast, the worst thing that can happen is a policy lapsing for failure to pay a premium inadvertently, right? So you always tell your clients, pay the premium. Even if you've messed up the trust, even if you've made a mistake there, that stuff can be corrected, whatever, and worked around, but pay the premium. Don't let it lapse for failure to pay. So sometimes what happens is you run out of time and you don't have time to get the money into the trust, then into the trust, and then out of the trust to pay the premium. So people pay the premiums directly to the insurance company. It also comes up in other situations where people just forget and they get a notice in the mail for the trust and they just pay the check directly. So the question is, does that qualify, right? Again, if we're going back to trying to qualify payments to the trust for annual exclusion treatment, so that we're not making taxable gifts to the trust, will that qualify for the withdrawal rights? Can somebody have a right to withdraw an asset that didn't actually make it into the trust, right? The trust says you have a right to withdraw that which is contributed to the trust. But if the policy premium is paid indirectly and instead it's paid directly to the insurance company, it never actually ends up in the trust. So how do you exercise a right of withdrawal over that? Well, the good news is that it can qualify. There is a case on that from 2011. For those who are interested, it's the estate of Clyde Turner. It's a tax court memo case, 2011-209. The key thing in that case, and it's a little unclear exactly how to make that work if you don't have the right provision in your trust, but if you can, if you're involved in the drafting stage, right, make sure that the trust says that the withdrawal rights can be exercisable with respect to indirect gifts as well as direct gifts. So that court case said, look, you can do it. It's fine because it authorized the right of withdrawal with respect to that indirect gift. So that's there. The last thing I'll add is that what happens if you don't send crummy notices at all? That happens more frequently than we'd like to admit, probably. And I would say it's probably very common when you have life insurance trust where trustees are family members and they're not getting advice on a consistent basis from either their attorney or the insurance advisor, or you know, they got the advice initially and then they've just forgotten to send these crummy notices. What happens? What do you do with a situation where you haven't sent out the crummy notices? Well, thankfully, I think there's probably a way to address that if you can catch it. And the way I would do it, again, this comes back to the two key factors of knowledge and opportunity. On the assumption that you've sent at least one crummy notice, on the assumption that your family is generally aware of the planning that you're doing, you can have the beneficiaries sign an acknowledgement after the fact and say, yes, I was aware that I had this withdrawal right. I was aware that contributions were being made to the trust, and I had this withdrawal right for all these years. And sure, no crummy notice was sent to me, but it didn't matter. You know, the first crummy case didn't involve a written notice at all. So you don't have to have it in writing. Is it better? Sure, that's your proof. But at the end of the day, you could do an affidavit like this, but I would check with counsel before you did that, just to be sure.
Wow, that's great. I think you really pointed out a lot of kind of key tips here. It seems like such a straightforward thing, I think, especially for even us as maybe advisors or attorneys that are listening to read the trust, but I think that it is really crucial that we're ensuring that both clients as well as trustees are really understanding the actual trust terms. I think that's a really critical thing because, as you mentioned, trusts are very useful but can be very complex tools. So it's really important that we're understanding and aware of the intricacies of how they work and the terms of a specific trust to ensure it's being administered properly. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned indirect gifts and paying the premium to ensure a policy doesn't lapse, as well as kind of making sure that clients are working with their attorneys from the onset of drafting a trust to build in some flexibility to allow for things like indirect gifts. I think those are some really good points for our listeners. Emil, you mentioned earlier that the most critical issue in dealing with life insurance trusts is the policy itself. Can you explain a little bit what you mean?
Absolutely, Carly. This issue for me is explosive. I'm actually quite worried that over the next several years, we're going to see an onslaught of litigation by trust beneficiaries against trustees of life insurance trusts because the assets they were charged with safeguarding has imploded. For the life insurance professionals on this call, I think you'll understand what I mean. Everybody is aware of the older policies that aren't performing the way they were expected to perform, and many people are not tracking them as closely as they should. You know, as an estate planning lawyer, one of the most valuable tools in my arsenal are the other advisors who are collaborating with me to help the client. When it comes to life insurance, what I look for in a teammate is someone who has a deep understanding of the insurance landscape, right? This doesn't mean that, you know, it's somebody who can just quote me premiums for 10 different carriers at a time, right? It really means being able to explain to me and to the client what might happen to a policy if the underlying assumptions change even slightly, right? It means maintaining an ongoing and supportive relationship with the client to make sure that the policy that the client purchased is actually still a good investment. And I use that word investment actually with purpose because, you know, different policies look different, as you all know. And, you know, you've got your basic term insurance, which is not really an investment in the same way that a permanent policy is. But it's an investment, right? It's an investment in safeguarding the future of your surviving spouse and minor children in the event of a disaster. So there's an investment component there. But the permanent coverage has a slightly different connotation, because that is really like an asset, and it functions like an asset as well. I mean, you talk about, with permanent coverage, you talk about things like internal rate of return, right? And that's the language of assets. That's the language of investing. And I want to be working with advisors who understand that and who can appreciate that, you know, sometimes when you make investments, they don't turn out the way you hoped they would. There are obviously guaranteed policies now. That is, you know, pretty predictable. That's like buying a muni bond. And I actually love the guaranteed UL products these days as a replacement investment for someone's muni bond portfolio, that sliver of their portfolio. I mean, I think it's fantastic. But it has to be treated as an asset. That means that it has to be reviewed, right? If someone's a trustee, or even if not, right, take it out of the context of a trust for a moment, right? If you have an investment portfolio of $5 million that you've invested, you know, with, you've given to a broker to invest for you, you're reading those statements at least monthly. You know, you may not go over it with a fine-tooth comb every month, but you're going to meet with the advisor who's investing the funds probably quarterly, maybe semi-annually, at least annually, and you're going to ask questions. You say, why is this declining over here? Why is this one going up? Should we invest this way or that way? You ask all those kinds of questions with a liquid portfolio. People don't ask those questions with life insurance, because oftentimes the assumption is, well, if I buy this policy, I'll just pay these premiums and I'll get what I've paid for. So that is certainly true with a term policy. It's also true with the guaranteed UL products, but it's a lot less true, certainly, with the older cash value products, the older whole life products, which are based more on market forces and have a tendency to fluctuate. And this issue is important because, you know, when you look now at life insurance trusts that are holding older policies, and, you know, specifically these older cash value policies, right? People purchase these policies for a variety of different reasons. And their circumstances 15, 20, 25, 30 years ago were in one situation. They were in one box. Now their situation is totally different. But their expectation was that, gosh, if I paid this premium for X number of years, this policy will be fully funded and I won't have to pay anything anymore. But we all know what's happened over the years. We all know that the interest rates have declined drastically. And that has had a significant impact on those older cash value policies. So much so that many premiums continue to need to be paid for years beyond what was expected. And if you're lucky enough that you just have to pay for an extra couple of years the same premium amount that you were paying before, that's not so terrible. Other policies are actually lapsing because you can't possibly make the premiums pay high enough premiums to pull them back into full function. And so this is what I worry about, right? And I worry about that because people weren't watching these policies closely. And when you pick off a situation today, there's not often a lot that you can do. You know, sometimes you're too far gone. But what I'm trying to talk to professionals about today is take a look at your entire portfolio. So if you're a lawyer serving as trustee of a portfolio of 50 life insurance trusts, if you are a fiduciary services firm that serves as trustee of life insurance trusts, and you have a portfolio in your firm, take a look at that entire portfolio and have every single one of those policies reviewed immediately. Some of them you'll identify as being quite old, and gosh, you're gonna say, oh, we've got a problem here, what do we do? But that problem is going to exist whether you look at it or not, and if you catch it early enough, there may be things you can do to salvage something in that trust. It may be a very uncomfortable conversation you're going to have with the beneficiaries or even the grantor, if the grantor is still alive. I guess if the grantor is alive, then that's what you're talking about. If the grantor is deceased, unless it's a second-to-die policy, then the policy's already been funded. But those can be uncomfortable conversations. But if you can at least start that conversation while there's still some value there that can be salvaged, maybe that's, you know, reducing the face value of the coverage or swapping the cash value policy for a guaranteed UL policy if they're still insurable. That conversation may be uncomfortable, but I guarantee you it will be less uncomfortable than the conversation that goes, some bad news. The policy you were paying for all these years has lapsed. You now have $0 in this trust. That will be a very bad conversation. But that's what I fear is coming, because people are not being proactive about this. Trustees are not being proactive about this. And I would say to the insurance advisors who are listening in, there is an opportunity here on two levels. The most important level is the opportunity is to do right by your clients. and to recognize that, gosh, I sold a lot of policies many years ago that were the right policies at the time, right? I just want to be clear about something. Because a policy is failing today doesn't mean that it was the wrong policy sold at the time. And that's something that clients are going to have a hard time understanding, but you can explain it. It wasn't a mistake for someone to buy a whole life policy 25 years ago. That's what was in the market at the time, and that's what was being sold, and they were good policies, and they were doing good things. The problem is that today, because of market forces that were out of control of the insurance companies, they're just not doing what they were meant to do. So pick up the phone and call and say, you know, I'm a little bit worried about this policy. It's not doing what it was supposed to do. Let's see if we can fix this, or let's see if we can preserve as much of this as possible. Don't bury your head in the sand and ignore the situation. So that's point number one. There actually is a business opportunity here, right? And it is to go in there and say, you know, I'm catching this early enough where there's still, now there's been a good amount of cash value buildup, but, you know, there may be an opportunity to convert that cash value policy into a GUL policy instead, you know, give them the comfort that they're looking for, most likely because their circumstances have changed, right? Oftentimes, I saw this a lot, was older cash value policies were sold to clients who were looking for access to cash value. As you all know, cash value policies were pitched as a good supplement for retirement planning. And, you know, but they were thrown into life insurance trusts for one reason or another, and probably the wrong reason. And now, thankfully, many of those clients don't need that supplemental retirement. So you can get rid of the cash value. It's no longer needed. So you have an opportunity there to actually take that cash value, lock in the death benefit, maybe even get a better death benefit. So there are opportunities there. But the idea here is to do this periodic review, take a look at these policies, see what's going on, and, you know, and just assess the policy. Keep in mind that it is an asset. That, I think, help people with their framework going forward for maintaining these things.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think you make some really good points about permanent insurance being an asset, kind of like any other investment would be. I think most of our listeners are aware that life insurance products are very complex products that you can't just set and forget. But I think it's a very interesting point that you make. You wouldn't buy, for example, a mutual fund or a CD or even a savings account and buy that today and then just never look at it again. So the same should kind of hold true, I think, for life insurance. And I think it's really important that we are encouraging our clients and trustees to understand the inner workings of the policy and the variables surrounding it, because I think if we don't, as you pointed out, you can certainly run into a lot of really, really serious issues. So absolutely, we should be encouraging owners and trustees to understand these products and really do annual reviews. I think you also offer some really good insight from the perspective as a trust and estates attorney into kind of what kind of advisor you like to work with, and from where you're sitting, what makes a great advisor. I think that's some really good insight for our listeners today. And from your point of view, that a great advisor is someone who not only understands the underlying policy and how that works, but also is really proactive in kind of doing those annual reviews. So today we've kind of already talked a lot about trust-owned life insurance and the many benefits to having an ILIT as the owner and beneficiary of a life insurance policy, which namely is estate tax exclusion and enhanced management and control. Are there cases that you see kind of from where you're sitting as an attorney where an ILIT might actually be problematic or where individual ownership might actually make more sense?
Most definitely. I love this question because so many people fall into, I should say, so many lawyers and also, frankly, life insurance agents, right? You know, everybody thinks, oh, life insurance policy, let's throw it into an ILIT, right? That's sort of the pattern. And I think a lot of people fall into that pattern without thinking about what it means and why are we doing these things to begin with. And for me, I have noticed, and at least in my practice, that I'm doing fewer life insurance trusts these days. Obviously, it depends on the type of client. For my client base, that, you know, it spans the gamut from, you know, the young up-and-comers, entrepreneurs, you know, net worth, you know, below $5 million to clients with hundreds of millions of dollars. But in that space, where the majority of people are, which is, let's call it the 0 to $10 to $15 million client, where most, you know, life insurance people are focusing, in that space, because of the increased exemption, right, life insurance trusts are not as valuable, right? You mentioned that the primary play originally was the estate tax exemption, right? And to avoid paying estate tax. So you'd keep this asset that was going to be pretty significant in your estate outside of your estate by using a properly drafted life insurance trust. But of course now, with the estate tax exemption bordering on $11 million combined for spouses, it's capturing so many more people in that exemption bucket so that you don't need to have a life insurance trust. And why wouldn't you want to have a life insurance trust? Well, you're going to pay an attorney to draft a life insurance trust. And then, as we talked about before, you have these crummy notice requirements. You've got these annual review things. There are other expenses to administer this thing on an annual basis. And depending on who's doing it, right, some corporate fiduciaries will charge upwards of $3,000 a year to administer a life insurance trust, right? Other people charge $1,000 a year to administer a life insurance trust. But what are you getting out of that? And the other thing is that, look, but when I first started practicing and I had my own family, young child, the first thing I did, the estate tax exemption, I'm going to date myself now, the estate tax exemption was just going to get to $1 million, right? And so I got my first 30-year term policy for $1 million, and I threw it into a life insurance trust because that's what we were doing. That's what everybody was doing at the time, because as soon as I had $1 million, it would be subject to 55% estate tax, and I certainly didn't want to lose that. So I threw it into a life insurance trust at the time. But what's the reality? The reality is, you guys know the percentages better than I do, but it's a tiny, tiny, minuscule percentage of all term policies actually pay a death benefit, right? Because most people outlive the policies, or they realize that they don't need them anymore, so they let them lapse, or for whatever reason. It's a variety of them, but they don't pay out. And so for the majority of people who have term policies, putting them in a life insurance trust seems to be overkill to me. For my money, it's really a math question, right? If it's not likely to pay out and you're going to pay a lot of money to have it drafted and to maintain it, you have to weigh that against the benefits of having it in a trust and excluding it from your estate. Now, there's federal and some states, if you're in a state like I am, in Massachusetts, has a $1 million estate tax exemption. I've heard the argument, well, you can do Massachusetts estate tax planning, right? Now, of course, the highest rate in Massachusetts is 16%, and it takes a while to get there. So even if you're trying to save 16%, I'm not gonna scoff at that, because it's, you know, we do planning to save that all the time. But with a term policy, you know, you have to remember why you're buying it. A term policy is being purchased for pure insurance reasons, typically, that if you die young, you need to protect your surviving spouse and children, and likely minor children. That money is going to be spent down if that's what it's for. And so if you're worried about an estate tax problem, you won't have it at your first death, because the $1 million that I leave to my surviving spouse will get a marital deduction. I won't pay tax on it. And then at my spouse's second death, well, she'll hopefully spend it down, taking care of herself and my children. So I don't need to worry about the tax, likely, in that scenario. So the other thing is, if you're worried about the other issue, why, oh gosh, I have minor beneficiaries, I want to have a trust, I want to name some trust that will protect my kids. Well, you can do that, right? Most people, if they're doing their planning right, they've at least set up basic wills and revocable trusts. There's no reason why you shouldn't name your revocable trust as the beneficiary of your term insurance policy. So that's sort of the way to protect your minor children. Now, again, this discussion here is mostly about the term insurance in life insurance trusts. When you have permanent insurance, I feel a little less strongly about the argument. You know, you can certainly do a life insurance trust if you've got permanent coverage. Typically, the permanent coverage is going to be, I think, would be slightly higher, but obviously it's guaranteed. You know it's going to pay out, assuming you pay the premiums. And so if you do want to know that you're going to avoid even state estate tax with a guaranteed policy, I feel a little bit more comfortable using a life insurance trust. But even then, I'd look at the numbers and see what's going on and what the concerns might be.
That's great. I think you make some really good points here. Again, trust can be really, really efficient vehicles, but from a practical standpoint, sometimes it might make better sense to have individual ownership of a life insurance policy. I think you briefly touched on here too is beneficiary designations. They are really crucial, and if you are working with a minor beneficiary, I think there's some considerations there too for clients to be aware of, and I think this is an issue that we're going to need to continue to help educate our clients on going forward as well. So another thing that kind of comes up often here in our advanced markets group are advisors coming to us with clients who would like to transfer ownership of an existing policy. In that case where a client's looking to transfer ownership, is there anything that they should be looking out for?
Well, certainly. Anytime you're transferring an asset like life insurance, it should raise a flag right away. The first thing I would say is if an agent gets asked the question about it, the best bet is to refer the client over to an attorney to think about the legal ramifications. This is not something that I think insurance agents should dabble in because it's fraught with pitfalls, and you know nobody likes to make that kind of a costly mistake. It would not be a good thing. But you certainly should be aware of the issues, and I think I always find it's helpful when I get a call from an insurance professional who says, "Listen, a client just asked me about this. I think I've got a transfer for value issue here, or I've got another issue here. Can we talk about it?" I love those calls because I love working with the thoughtful advisors who are saying, "Gosh, I know there's an issue here. I flagged it, and let's discuss and figure out what's best for the client." Those are great calls for me. So the two things I would say that people should be aware of, first of all, the topic for me comes up, well, I've got a policy that I bought in my own name, and now I want to put it into a trust. What do I need to be aware of? The first thing is what's commonly referred to as the three-year rule, code section 2035 for those who care. If you make a gift of a policy into the trust, it can get pulled back into your estate if you die within 3 years of that. Not a huge concern for most people because they're usually doing that when they're still young, but even still, be aware of it. There are ways around that. My favorite one is actually to fund the trust, assuming that your trust is a grantor trust, that the life insurance trust is a grantor trust, fund it with cash, and then purchase the policy from yourself. The cash is a little bit circular, but if the trust purchases it, you avoid the three-year rule. You know, it's not a complex transaction, but again, I would consult with an attorney about that transaction. And then the other one comes up in a variety of times as well, the transfer for value rule. This is an interesting and complex one, and we can spend a little bit of time going over it, but it's really detailed, and I don't want this call to be based, someone should base their decisions on what we talk about today specifically because there's a lot more to think about, and it's never as simple as the rules make it out to be. But the transfer for value rules can be found under Section 101 of the code. From a background perspective, the baseline rule that everybody knows is that proceeds of a policy are not subject to income tax, right? Everybody knows that. However, if a policy is actually sold, right, that converts the future proceeds into taxable income, and that's not a good result. So you have to be aware that and this comes up often in the business context with buy-sell agreements, or other contexts where you've got partners and using them for business reasons and such. So there are some key exceptions to this transfer for value rule that I'm just going to flag, and we'll leave it at that, to know that these kind of transfers are okay, and you're not going to run afoul of this rule, and the proceeds will still remain tax-free from an income tax perspective. So the first is that you can make transfers between a grantor and a grantor trust. This is what I mentioned earlier with the 2035 situation. You know, you can sell your policy to a life insurance trust that is a grantor trust. A brief word on a grantor trust, it's that the income in a trust is taxable to the grantor. Another time we can talk about in greater detail what that means, but most people should have an understanding of what a grantor trust is. Take a look and see if anybody needs to reach out to me. I'm happy to talk to them about it. The other transfer that is exempt from this concern is transfers between spouses. So if I have a policy and I transfer it to my spouse, there's no transfer for value problem. It's still tax-free income of the proceeds. The next one is that transfers to the insured, so if a corporation owns a policy and transfers it, or a partnership owns a policy and transfers it to me, if it's on my life, that's not a problem. Or transfers to a partnership in which the insured is a partner, or to a corporation in which the insured is a shareholder or an officer. None of those transfers trigger the transfer for value rule, and the proceeds are still income tax free. And then finally, transfers between two grantor trusts. This is similar to the first one, but I like to flag this one because it's a great tool for unwinding or getting out of what I call, let's say, a bad trust, right? Let's say you had an older life insurance trust that had provisions in it that you weren't so thrilled with and you want to make changes to it. You can create a new grantor trust, a new life insurance trust, with the provisions that you like, fund it with cash, and use the cash to then purchase the policy from the old trust. So Again, that won't run afoul of the transfer for value rules, and instead you'll end up with the new trust owning the policy. And of course, figuring out the amount that you need to fund, that you need to purchase the policy, that's a different question. You've got to get the policy valued and figure out how much you need to spend on that. And then, of course, the old trust will then have the cash that you use to purchase the policy. So you'll still have something in that trust to administer on the, along the terms that you didn't like necessarily, but so be it. So that's the transfer for value rule.
That's great. I do think that we should really be encouraging our advisors to work with counsel on potential transfer for value issues at all times. And I think you first and foremost kind of went over some really good strategies, interesting strategies on how we might be able to work around the three-year look back. For example, funding the trust with cash and then having the policy purchased by the trust. I also do think it's really helpful you took some time to go into the transfer for value issues that kind of come up time and time again. We see this a lot in our advanced markets group. And as you mentioned, it's often is in the business context. And I think to the extent that our listeners have questions on this, I would encourage them to contact legal counsel or our advanced markets group, because in the business context in particular, there's lots of mistakes that can be made, and if they are made, they're detrimental, but they can easily be avoided, such as some of these transfer for value issues, as well as some of the notice and consent requirements under Code Section 101J. So I think we've covered a lot of really good stuff here today, but before I let you go, one thing that we've been seeing a lot of in advanced markets is with a new President Trump and a Republican-controlled House and Senate, I think 2017 is poised to be a year of significant change. And we've been seeing many advisors that have a lot of questions about that and have really been wondering about what that may mean for taxes and estate planning and kind of what the future of the estate tax may be. Would you agree that it's a mistake to hold off on planning until these laws are fleshed out more?
So I wish I had a crystal ball, right, like we all do, to understand what's going to happen tax-wise. But as you know, Carly, there are a lot of reasons to do planning that aren't tax-related. That includes life insurance, of course. Life insurance, as we talked about early on, there you have to ask the reason why you're planning and what you care about. And, you know, look, at bottom, there are two main components these days: taxes and taking care of your planning and what you want to do for your family, making sure that your assets are protected, making sure that they're going to the places you want them to go. The main construct really is that planning component. Where do you want the things to go? The tax component is sort of, we sort of wedge that into the plan to make it as efficient as possible. But if you know, and there's some people out there we know that say, my primary objective is to avoid taxes at all costs. Okay. Most people, their primary objective is to take care of their family. And yeah, I would love to be doing that in the most tax efficient way as possible. So tax planning is sort of the subset. So if you take taxes out of the equation, and I'm not so sure that that's what's going to happen here, I think there will be some scenario here where there will be some kind of tax at death. Whether they're calling it an estate tax or a capital gains tax or some other thing, there will be something, I think, in place. But that being said, you know, you shouldn't put things on hold. The only things that I would put on hold right now would be making taxable gifts. I wouldn't do anything right now or advise a client to do anything right now that would incur a gift tax today. So that if I were to go out and make a $20 million gift to somebody and use up my full exemption and then have to pay gift tax on that transfer, I don't think I would do that today, because I don't know what the tax law might look like 6 months from now, and I might be paying taxes unnecessarily. That's the kind of stuff I would avoid. But I certainly wouldn't avoid doing a basic estate plan, making sure that you've got the chassis built to provide for your family. I certainly wouldn't avoid making sure that there are assets in there to fund that plan, whether it's starting out, if you're young, with term insurance to make sure that your family is protected, designating your revocable trust as the beneficiary of that policy so that you can fill up any kind of credit shelter trust that may still exist if there is a tax system, or if not, at least fill up that family trust to take care of your surviving spouse and children. And then, you know, there are a variety of other reasons why you would have insurance. The two other things that I'll flag today are the following. The first is, you know, there are people in this universe who are in highly leveraged businesses, or they are in startups and they've got a lot of paper value that won't vest until, you know, until for a certain number of years. And if they were to die in the short run, they won't actually realize any of that gain, and their families won't enjoy the fruits of their labors. And so short-term term insurance might be really good for somebody like that, right? They may have a lockup for a number of years, and if they die during that window, they won't get anything. Hedge that with a 10-year term insurance. It can be a $50 million policy. It doesn't matter. Hedge against the value of that lockup in case you die early, unexpectedly, right? And then the other one that, to me, is always going to be an issue, and this is not only a life insurance thing, but, you know, there are families that have vacation homes, right? The family compound, or whatever you want to refer to it. These families want to hold on to these properties for the benefit of their children. The problem is that their children, who all come together for holidays, summers, or whatever it is, they all go there while mom and dad are still alive. But after mom and dad pass, the kids spread out, right? Let's say, you know, I'm here in Massachusetts. We've got a lot of people with homes on Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, the Cape, right? That's nice if you live in Massachusetts. But if you've moved to California, if you've moved to Florida, if you've moved to Texas, how likely are you to actually come back and use that property? But mom and dad insist, no, we're going to keep this thing, and we're going to share, everybody's going to share ownership. Well, the problem is that there's a cost to maintaining that property on an annual basis, right? There's a cost of taxes. There's a cost of home improvements, maintenance, landscaping, whatever it may be. And that gets expensive. And if you've got one child that uses the property more often than the others, the other children are going to be very unhappy with sharing the cost of maintaining the property. So I have always found that life insurance can be a really nice tool to fund a pool of wealth to support that property. If the parents really desperately want to hold on to that property, despite counsel that might say, you know, not such a good idea, if they insist on it, I always tell them, look, if you're going to have this property, you either need to put your own cash into that property, whether it's held in an LLC or a separate trust, fund it with some amount of cash that will sustain the property for years to come so that there's no burden on any one child or there's no burden on multiple children to maintain the property when only one of them actually uses it. It will prevent infighting among your children and give you a lot more flexibility. If they have the cash to do it and they don't need life insurance, well, that's a separate question, right? If people have liquid wealth of $500 million, do they need life insurance? I don't know. That's a different question. That's an investment question. But if you are tied up, if a lot of your value in your estate is tied up in illiquid assets, well, insurance can be a great tool here to actually fund a vehicle to protect that compound for generations to come.
I think that's really interesting, Emil. And I think you make some really great points today. And I want to thank you for pointing out some of the unique ways that life insurance can be used as a tool to help meet planning goals, regardless of what's going on in the political environment. And at that point, planning really is so much more than tax planning. I do think that first and foremost, when we are talking about planning, whether we are advisors, insurance advisors, or wealth managers, or trust and estates attorneys, when we're talking about planning, we're really first and foremost talking about ensuring that clients' goals and wishes are being fulfilled for their loved ones. So I think in that context, planning is always going to be crucial, regardless of what's going on politically or economically. And to that point, too, I think today we've covered a lot of really good things. It's really essential to encourage our clients to work with their attorneys and advisors through all stages of the planning process. As we kind of discussed today, that really means everything from initial consultations and goal defining on the onset to ongoing policy review and trust administration. So we want to thank you very much again for your time today. We really appreciate all of your insight, and we hope that our listeners also really enjoyed the show today. Thank you, Ben.
It was my pleasure.
If you would like to hear more about today's discussion or any other past topic covered by this program, go to jhamradio.com. That's jhamradio.com. I'm Tanya Ittings, and you have been listening to John Hancock's Advanced Markets Radio. For the financial and professional use only, not for use with the public, insurance products are issued by John Hancock's Life Insurance Company, USA, Boston, Mass., 02116, not licensed in New York, and John Hancock's Life Insurance Company of New York, Vahalia, New York, 10595. This material is for informational purposes only. Although many of the topics may involve tax, legal, or accounting issues, neither John Hancock nor any of its agents, employees, or registered representatives are in the business of offering such advice. This material material is not intended or recorded to be used with and cannot be used for the purpose of avoiding any penalty that may be imposed by the Internal Revenue Service. This recorded material may have been recorded to support the promotion or marketing of the transactions or topics addressed in this recorded material. Individuals interested in these topics should consult with their own professional advisor to examine legal, tax, accounting, or financial aspects of these topics.